part two of the series of Faith Under Repression, and this is the memory of the struggle. The idea of the memory of the struggle is firstly a biblical one, that we know that the way the Old Testament has preserved the living faith of the interaction between God and his people has always also been to preserve the memory of the struggle of that faith. Whenever the people of Israel had been in crisis of their faith, they were always reminded of where they come from and how they had encountered God throughout that struggle. And it is not by accident that many, many years later, when they were settled in Canaan and they were developing laws and regulations of interacting together, they started those laws, for example, by remembering that it is the God who took them out of Egypt who is now giving them these laws. Without that memory of that struggle, they wouldn't. And even when they were in Babylon, they kept alive that memory. When they were struggling after the post-exile period, they were actually able to survive with that memory of the struggle. And so sometimes when you look at conflict problems or at the conflict issues, it's important to ask yourself, where does this thing come from, to get a historical perspective of it, because that historical perspective actually will give you the proper balance and proper information. Now, I'm going to go through with you a very sketchy past history of South Africa. And let me say that in each of the times that I will highlight, I will be focusing on A, trying to answer the two questions: who were the major actors during that time, and B, what were the major issues around there. And I'm sure you will follow with me. This story is going to be very short, and some of you will link up, will remember some of the things as I go through with it. My intention at the end would be to discuss more detail the present situation. What actually is happening presently? What are the issues, and who are the people who want what? Because I think there is quite a lot of confusion, a lot of lack of clarity. And part of that lack of clarity is the result that the information happening, the events are not really properly being communicated. And I thought that we could spend this time, because that those issues of what is happening now is related to issues of what is likely to happen in future. What if people are going to sit down and negotiate, what is it that they are negotiating? What are the likely agendas? And my main interest, over and above all, is who are the actors behind this play, this theater that is happening in the country. So if you could follow it in that way: what are the issues, who are the actors? And we'll go that stage by stage, and you will discover a very fascinating story, a history of a people, unfolding. And I'm going to deliberately, for today, I'm going to deliberately underplay the church as an actor, simply because tomorrow I will be doing that. The church under apartheid, what has been its witness? but it will appear here and there. Now, firstly, let me just say that the SET is presently, South Africa is said to have a population of about 36 million. And out of that 36 million, 30 million would belong to the so-called non-whites. And 6 million would be white people. Now, as you know, that amongst the non-whites, they are divided into three groups, which is the Africans, which are black people, native blacks, and then there is the people of mixed color, who we call colors in South Africa. And the third group are Asians or Indians, those who are descendants of the from India. Now, after my presentation, after some time, and then I'll break, and then you'd ask me questions. And I've divided also this era into three sections, which is the colonial era, the imperialist era, and the era of black resistance. Now, one of the important differences that you will discover when you look at the situation in South Africa as compared to situations elsewhere in Africa, where they had the same problem, say, of a colonial powers stationed there, is that in South Africa we moved from a colonial era proper and went on to the second stage of that, which was an imperialist era. And it has important differences, which I will highlight as I proceed. It is accepted that the first white people who arrived at the subcontinent of Africa, at the Cape, was in 1652, and they were Dutch traders who were on their way to the east and who were looking for a halfway station to rest and to restock and to proceed. Their interest whatsoever was not in any way to make a home of the country. But a number of things happened. The first one is that they discovered that the climate there was superb. And they also discovered that it can actually be more than a halfway station. It can also be a home. And therefore, they settled there. On the whole, their relationship, I will be discussing the native question as an issue, the actors and the issue being what this mean to the people on the ground there. On the whole, there was very little contact with the natives. Any contact that was had, it was to get some of them as laborers on the gardens, on the plantations that they started there. And there was also no struggle for land. They found their plot of land and they decided to use that, and everybody had his own. And the other issue related to that is because the natives who were in that part of land, of area, were more nomadic type of people who were always on the move. So then they just did not feel offended by suddenly white people arriving here and making use of the land. They just felt, well, if they can make good use of that land, it's fine, we'll find another land. And there was plenty of land there. I can mention that was not to be the case, because the second phase of the history is that land became a serious problem. Now, it comes mainly after 1806. Essentially what happened is that certain things happened in Europe after the Napoleonic Wars, that part of the battles of Napoleon led to the one of the prince, the Dutch princess, abdicating, and then Britain took hold of the former colonies of France, which were taken from the Dutch. And in the end, just an agreement, an event happened in Europe, but that event led to the fact that in South Africa, that colony changed hands. It became a British colony. The British had never been to South Africa then. They simply defeated the power in Europe, and then the whole thing was exchanged. But what happened is that they started sending their soldiers to go and take over the new colony. And they sent a governor to govern the colony with British laws now. And so we started having the British settlers go in there. Now, as you do know that there were other revolutions in Europe, the French revolutions in particular were they changed the history of Europe. And the 1830 revolutions in France in particular had an important impact on the history of South Africa. The first one is that the 1830 revolutions resulted in the call by European powers, especially by the colonial powers, to the emancipate slaves, to declare slavery illegal. And you do know that historically America was exempted from that, because it just felt it is not ready to do that. And actually that led to its own problems. But as the 1830 revolutions led to the emancipation of slaves, to make slavery illegal, it meant that in those colonies of the empires, that same thing was. Britain applied that around 1833, and then it started implementing that policy in its colonies, and then it sent, there was a lot of lobbying in South Africa to say, no, leave us alone, we don't interfere with you, please allow us to exercise, to practice our own form of slavery here. But unfortunately it was not easy, and I could mention here the church played a role, because already the church had made a presence by this time, by the 1830s, and the church was able to say, no, if something under the colonial power is illegal, it must also be illegal in wherever it's satellites and colonies. And so therefore an edict was passed that even in South Africa slavery must be illegal. Slavery in South Africa was in a very strange way. Firstly, the natives there were never slaves. They were never taken into slavery. They simply, because they resisted completely. But because the natives resisted, the settlers imported slaves who were working there, and they imported them from Malay, from other eastern areas, and so on. So we had slavery, but it was really not the Africans themselves. I mean, they just didn't and wouldn't accept that. But then the impact of that law that there must be no slavery on the colony led to the first conflict between the Dutch and the British. The Dutch were there since 1652. They had their own policies. They tolerated the changeover in 1806, but then that changeover, they were not happy that suddenly there's a governor who must rule them in a new language and many things. But still, it didn't interfere with their family affairs. But when the law came that now you do not only have to recognize the British, but you must also recognize the British law, and one of them is that you must never hold a slave within your household, they felt this is enough. And they decided to move away from the British Empire or sphere of rule, jurisdiction, to run away as far up into the African continent as possible. And this is the phase which we call the Great Trek. And they moved northwards. And as they moved northward, they established two republics, which the first one is called the Oranje Free Republic, and the second one is called the Transvaal Republic. They are the first Boer republics. Somehow the British did not worry about that. They just left them, okay, if you want to go away, you can go away, as long as when where we are. And I can mention that the Afrikaner, or the Dutch then, they left with their slaves. They said that, no, you're interfering with our affairs. They took their slaves, got into big, you know. They left like the I always imagine the type of the, how the Great West trek in America. They left that like that. For them, it was the northward move. Now, that had two important things. The first one is that two nationalisms started to exist, which are very European and colonial in terms of wanting to get something for themselves. But it also meant that as they were moving north, now they encroached on the land that was really settled by the native blacks. And so the first land struggles started. There were two primary ways in which it was resolved. The first one was to shoot the people and take over the land. And the second one was to send missionaries to tame them and take over the land after that. So it was an interesting history of our struggle that day. They said that they would first bring their Bible, and if you don't understand it, they'll then come with a gun and don't negotiate. And at the end of the day, the natives were dominated. They hand over the land, they ran away and grouped into the little piece where they think that they could be in peace. And there was no dealings with these settlers, except where you have been completely dominated and you have no way to survive, your farms have been taken, you had to then go and be a worker for them, cook, help them build, help them do their farms. That was basically the era. Now, to some extent, a new phase happened, which is the phase that is different from the story in other countries in Africa, in the sense that the European colonialists now had established themselves not so much as people who are coming and retaining a home in Europe, but they established themselves now more as people who are now making that place a home. Now, it's an important it's a point of historical difference when you compare the later wars against colonialism in Africa, in Kenya, in Zambia, in Tanzania, even in what was called Belgium, Congo, etc. That in the sense that in those areas, when the local people started to say that, no, we want self-rule, it was very easy for the Belgians to withdraw, for the French to withdraw, for the British to move out of Zambia and Kenya and Tanzania, primarily by negotiation in London. They could sign and say, okay, fine, take care of yourself. Now, in South Africa, it became a completely impossible thing to resolve colonial settlement in that way, because here were people now who could no longer say that, okay, fine, take over, we'll go back home, as it happened in other areas. Portuguese, for example, did the same thing in Mozambique and in Angola. When they realized that they can no longer justify their stay there, they simply handed over the independence declarations and withdrew. Now you get a situation where in South Africa it was beginning the roots of these people who are now emerging out of Africa. And that is why, after this period, when the Dutch settlers moved out of the Cape, they felt that they've been sold out by their king in Holland. And so they actually disowned their colonial parents. And therefore they started to even develop their own unique culture and language and nationality, and began to call themselves no longer Dutch or what, but purely Afrikaners. Now, Afrikaner is a Dutch version of African. So now a new nationalism was emerging, which is that. Now, I want to move briefly into the second phase, which is the imperialist era, because they're very, very important era. Now, the relationship was like that. The British knew where they had their own control and where their rules applied, and more people came. The French Huguenots came when they were persecuted in France because of their religion. They went to South Africa. Some of them came to America. Not so Mayflower group. Some of them went to South Africa. They settled there, and the places were called Stellenbosch. They built beautiful French cottages, and they stayed there. Quite a very important cultural impact on the country. The British, more and more Britons arrived, especially as they were colonizing New Zealand and Australia. So it was now more of a halfway station. Those who did not want to go. And an interesting fact is that most of these people who were willing to take this risky adventure of going to far away, it is said that they were people who were looking for better, more freedom, more way of doing things, where they felt that in their home country, the class system, or they were not really at home, in the sense that they were either discriminated against or so. So they were really looking for what you may call freedom. And I think it's an important thing to recognize, because these are the people who knew oppression, who hated it. But it's important that when they arrived in South Africa, they became the oppressors, instead of bringing that spirit that they left their home country with. Now, let me run through this imperialist era, which I just called imperialist because they're the important.
Question, where did the term Boer come up?
The term Boer is a farmer.
A Dutch farmer?
Yeah, it's Dutch for, I'm not sure whether it's still Dutch, but basically it means a farmer.
You refer to the settlers in the Great Trap?
Yes, it refers, they became, they were known as farmers. We call it the Boer. Is a person who is a farmer. So more, it has more to do with being rural. Today, when you say you are a Boer, we mean you are more rural. You are a person who works on the land. You're not urbanized. You're not industrialized.
It doesn't have any racial connotation.
No, it does. It does. It simply, for now, it means Afrikaner farmers. An important things. Now, as I said, that the British, on the whole, left the Dutch to go. Somehow the British felt that it's actually even better for them that these people must move out. But now it's important. Interesting things happened. The first one is that when the Dutch went further north, the area just above the area where they settled, just within the border where they settled, diamonds were found. Large deposits of diamonds, an area called Kimberley, where actually they say that diamonds were just picked up on the rivers. You know, you could just take a sieve and scoop the water and do this and take out a gem. And when the British heard that has happened, they immediately followed the Dutch and said, the place where you are, belongs to the natives. You don't touch anything there. And immediately as they said that, they brought lots of British prospectors to the place to go. Now that place is it's called Kokstad and so on, it's Kimberley now. And anyway, the Dutch were very bitter about that, and the British immediately set up laws as to how any prospectors to take diamonds here, it belongs to the colony, so the colony will have to get a share and so on. So at the end, the Dutch, those who were there, were allowed to prospect on those diamonds, provided they knew that they are under the colony. They were not happy, and they left and went further north again. Now, it's very, another interesting thing happened. Where they went in the north, gold was found. That is now in the Transvaal itself. That is the area of Johannesburg, where I come from. Gold was found. And again, the British said the same thing. Don't touch that it belongs to the natives, that area. We are protecting the natives here. And the Dutch just said, enough is enough, and they declared war. Then they fought a very big war, what is normally called the Anglo-Boer War, in 1899 to 1902. And it was reported in the whole of the world, and it was a very severe war because the concentration camps were used, because the Boers just felt enough is enough. They hated British nationalism. They organized guerrillas, they organized what and so on. Anyway, they were defeated. I mean, the British were just too powerful because they sent thousands and thousands of armies, soldiers, and they were defeated. But after they were defeated, now an interesting thing happened, which is that they made a joint policy. And that joint policy basically was that, listen, let us make peace. Let us try and get what we can get together. Let us improve the country. But then let us exclude the natives. And so the first legislations which were used to exclude the natives were passed after that. And the first thing that they did was to set up means of establishing what is called the Union of South Africa. Basically, the Union of South Africa was the bringing together of the two Boer republics with the British colonies and making a union under the British colony and applying the laws of a semi-independent union. Now, then the police were used to enforce the laws of the union. And the only relationship that they had with the African population was when they wanted them to come and work at the mines, and then they passed various laws that taxation, which forced them literally that we don't care whether you want or you don't want, you must come and work. And when the people said, no, I can't go and work, what do I work for? Because the natives just, we did not have a sense of money. What is a pound? What will it do? Then they passed a law. One of the interesting laws was the tax law, that you must pay a tax and you must pay it with hard currency. And many families would send one child, especially rich families, would send one child to go and work at the mines for one full year to get enough money to pay the tax for forever. So that they really didn't need, because they had chicken, anything to make a living, but they simply did not have money. So they would send the one son to the mines to work, earn money, and the family would use that money to pay that tax. And many other legislations were passed, like the hard tax. When they realized that this, what is called the poll tax, was not sufficient, they passed the hard tax. Anybody who has a hat should pay a tax. And people, because they didn't have money, they ultimately, many, many more were forced to go and work. Basically, there were laws which were passed to try and make and get people to come and work at the mines. At that time, it was dangerous. People were dying. So the people were actually refusing to go to work with good reasons, but then they couldn't. Now, so far, let me pause and and reflect with you important things. The first one is that the arrival of white people in the country was never resisted, not a single time. The first resistance that came in a very small scale was the resistance around the land issue. It was resolved where possible by sharing the land, and most of the time by conquering, by means of conquer. Laws were the British and the Dutch had no common interests, no common culture. They fought, and where they came together, it was when they agreed jointly to have a common policy against the natives. And they started using parliamentary means to pass laws, and that parliament clearly said, with exclusion of the African people. Now, we come to the era of black resistance, which I will run briefly so that I could come to the events happening today. When the news were circulated that a union is going to be passed with a constitution that excludes the natives, a delegation was sent to Britain to go and plead with the Queen that how can you allow that? You know, the African people had an unbelievable an aura of respect to the Queen. They just believe the Queen is such a righteous. If you can go and tell the Queen, it's like children when you say, if you can go and tell the mother, these people they are misbehaving because their queen doesn't know. Just go and tell the queen, then she will set the things right. They sent delegation hoping, you know, somehow childishly that the queen is such righteous, and they were disappointed because the queen did not listen to them. The basic issue was that we understand that a union is going to be formed, and in this union we are being excluded. Please, we also are the people of this country. Can we be part of this new law? And the Queen did not listen to them. In fact, to add insult to injury, she did not even receive them when they arrived in Britain. They were advised by missionaries to say, no, go to the Queen. If you go there, and the missionaries arranged a boat, they went, the delegation went, and the Queen simply did not even receive them. Anyway, the union was formed in 1910 and passed a constitution. The first constitution of South Africa was that. In 1912, the African people said that, since these people have formed a union without us, let us form our own organization. And the organization called African National Congress was formed. It is the oldest organization in Africa. I can't say about situations in Egypt and Ethiopia, although those areas did not form resistance organizations. And it was formed specifically with the aim of securing the same rights that the whites have for the Africans. And the means of doing that was to continue sending delegations to England, sending deputations, etc., etc. They failed dismally. If you can read the history between 1912, when they were founded, and 1948, it is a history of real disappointment. The union came with a what is called a native policy. Basically, that native policy was that we are going to appoint a minister, a cabinet minister, who is going not even a cabinet minister, but we're going to appoint a secretary who is going to be a native secretary, a white person. The role of that secretary would be to represent the interests of the natives in parliament and advise parliament about those policies that affect the law, the culture of the natives. And so it became what is called a paternalistic approach. Some white person would protect the interest of the natives themselves. Now, it was a very interesting era because at that time, more Africans were going to university, more were being educated, and more were increasingly being offended by a policy that was excluding them or by somebody who is supposed to be representing them. And they felt that they're really being treated like children, which actually is what was happening. Now, in any way, that was the policy from the Union up to 1948. Now, a number of things happened. The first important one is that there was the First World War and the Second World War. But the Second World War in particular, Africans were drafted to go and fight. And of course, they did not fight. All that they did was to carry weapons and tents and big things to clear the roads and so on. Many of them died. Some of them were shipwrecked in the ocean. But those who survived and came back saw the world and saw that we fought for something that is wrong, which is narcissism, which is the exclusion of other people, and we must not allow it to happen here. And when they said that, they did not win. They tried to exert themselves to say that what was happening in Europe, can it be happening? Can it happen here? I should mention an interesting point of history, that one of the important major actors in the United Nations, formation of United Nations organization, a very influential actor was then the Prime Minister of South Africa, who was called General Smuts. And then actually not only an important actor in the United Nations, but also an important actor in the founding of a document which is called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. Now, when that issue was already popularized, because he was a hero in South Africa. And ordinary Africans were proud that before this prime minister was so well respected. When then it was presented to him that, but if you are really talking about this, what about us? Because this declaration really speaks about the things we are really saying we want for ourselves. An interesting thing happened. Churchill, whom you know, said that, no, this is nothing to do with non-Europeans. When you talk about this human rights, they are for European people. And so General Smuts used that as an excuse to say, well, you see, chaps, I can't include you on this big deal. You are excluded, you are not Europeans. So this thing happening somewhere there in Europe is for the big bosses. In 1948, the Afrikaners won the elections. They have been ruling by pact with the British since the Union. And the government up to then was used to be called the Liberal Party government. But in 1948, Afrikaner nationalism ultimately won. And when they came, they did not come with a policy of hypocrisy like the British. They were very honest, and their honesty was simply that black and white don't mix. And they came with a policy which we today call apartheid, which simply means separateness or apartness. Now, with that policy of separate rule of the Afrikaners who came to power in 1948, the black people were made very, very angry. Now, a number of things happened between 1948 and 1960, but the major thing is that between 1948 and 1960, Separate Residential Areas Act was passed, Separate Universities Act was passed, Separate Schools Education Act was passed, separate toilet facilities, swimming pool and sporting facilities, you can think of many other separate things that were passed. And one of the major laws that was passed was the laws that required of African people to have in their body, in their person, a document declaring who they are, who is their employer, at 24 hours per day. If you fail to have that document, it used to call a passbook, you would be arrested. And the people resisted, and the resistance to that law. There were many other laws which were very offensive, but that one in particular led in 1960 to the shooting of the people who were demonstrating that at Sharpeville. And after the Sharpeville, the government responded by outlawing the organizations, by saying we're banning any political organization of African people. The ANC was banned, the leaders were arrested, and so on.
How many people were killed at Sharpeville?
69 were killed. And no need to mention that they were shot at the back running away, because the police simply said, go away, and then as people were running, they shot them to the air, and as people were scattered, they shot them. Then we have a phase in South Africa where the leadership went to prison, the Mandela and everybody around that era. Now, it's important to realize that the African National Congress was formed in 1912, and it never ever used any violent means. Believed throughout that these people are reasonable, they're intelligent, just argue with them, show them, they will see. Until 1961, 50 years. And after the shooting of Sharpeville, after the organization was unbanned, after the leaders were arrested, they formed a guerrilla movement to say that we have no option but to fight. And then that is where the armed struggle in South Africa started. And I don't want to we can discuss that in detail, but I can only mention that in spite of the attacks that the people faced for many years, one of the important policies of that armed struggle was that under no circumstances must a civilian, white, ordinary white person be a target of attack. Up to today, they made clear that we are fighting, we're going to blast government installations, we're fighting the army as representative of this rule. And no, they would never find a white child coming from school, which they could have hundreds of opportunities to do that. They never did that. It was a strict policy. Those armies, those guerrillas who did that, were faced trial. There were few who did that in the history since 1960, not more than five possibly, who shot civilians. But the strict rule of that was that no way. Anyway, that is just the politics of the armed struggle, which I just mentioned because it is another point of interest. Now, the armed struggle was not that of a great success because the government was organized for that. It simply arrested everybody and banned and hunted everybody, and it actually almost died because then they ran away and landed in Botswana, in Lesotho, in Mozambique, and it was just difficult for them to do that. And people were very intimidated in the country because if you were known to have any little connection with the banned organizations, you'd get 8 years. You know, you could have any attire that had a combination of colors of the ANC, black, green, and gold, like that T-shirt. Anything, you can have a cap, and let that cap have these three colors, you get 8 years, no mercy.
8 years?
Yes. There's a worker who was at the factory, and then he just took his mark and had these colors on the mark. I think he had time, maybe, decorated that mark with black, green, and gold, and he got 8 years. And it was not an isolated case. There are many such cases which happened. In any way, that means that any slight thinking about these organizations was not tolerated. Now, in 1976, the students boycotted schools and there were riots. Thousands of them ran away from the country. After that, I should mention that thousands died in the process because those disturbances started in 1976 and died down at the end of 77. So it was 1 full year of fighting with the police. And it was like the, what you call it, the anti-fada in Palestine, where the army would come with guns and small boys would pick up stones and throw and they are shot, they die. I mean, it was crazy, but it happened for 1 solid year. And many died and so on. Now, then in the 80s, the government realized, now this is the situation where we are. Important things happened in the 80s, which I'm going to try and run because we have actually spent more time. Important things happened in the 80s. The first one is that the government realized that it is not really going to solve the issue of what we call the African claims for equality with white people. We were saying that we're not asking anything different except to be, you know, what you are asking for yourself. We're also asking the same. If you are voting for your representatives, we really ask that we should really do that. It's an insult to have a people, you know, our people, for example, they go to school, they come to America, they study with, some of them are doing, sensitive things from nuclear physics, political scientists, some of them are top journalists, and when they go back home, they cannot exercise that. And you know, it's interesting thing is that they would study with some of the African colleagues from Ghana, Uganda, and when we go there, these other fellows get elected, they become Minister of Education, and we are just there, you know, we have really nothing, absolutely. And people really felt that, no, this thing cannot go on any longer. And I think the government realized also. Now, it tried in various ways. Now, the first way that they tried to do was to try and what we call the means of co-optation, to try and co-opt the key black people to govern with them. And that is where you find Chief Buthelezi emerging. So actually, it was not a full settlement of the problem, but to say, let's try and get a few. The second means that the government responded to these claims of the people was to seriously attend to the, what you call, bread and butter issues of the African people, which were very simple, that they did not have houses, their residential areas had no electrification, they were dark, the streets were unpaved, the schools of their children were bad, so they did not have, their hospitals were very inferior, did not have clinics, there was a high infant mortality. So the government realized that over and above the fact that you've got this problem, that these people want political equality, there are also socioeconomic problems, that they are very, very low, they are poor. And so the government also said that, let us try and resolve this. Now that's where they experienced the serious problem, because the problem was massive. And at the time when they decided to build houses, they relied on foreign aid, loans and investment. And when people said that foreign governments don't help these people to make apartheid better for us, and so, in other words, when sanctions came with Bishop Tutu, especially at Copenhagen, when he launched sanctions at Copenhagen, requesting the Danish government not to buy South African coal. And after that, sanctions were applied by other countries. Then the government lacked that money that it needed to attend to redress this. Now, you should realize that it's important to realize that they were actually not resolving the real problem. They were simply responding to the pressure that, okay, if they've got their own schools, let us at least try to make those schools better. But the issue of people was not really that we want now put ceilings on the schools. We were simply that we want to see the same education. Let us go to the same schools. Now, they had this, an economic crisis that they did not have sufficient money to respond to that. And the third thing, the response was the response that I spoke about of detaining people and changing them or eliminating them. So they had a three-pronged strategy: co-opt, attend to real, real acute grievances, and repress where need be. And that strategy failed. The workers got so organized that with the workers' stoppages coming on and on since 1984-85, the government had no option but to declare state of emergency. The students were so organized, the civic groups declared rent boycott, did not pay rent, and it did not pay rent at the time when the government needed money to, you know, to do this. And so the government was just paralyzed, and they had no option but to declare state of emergency, which made things worse. In 1986, and another one was declared, people were detained, and it did not succeed until that they responded to that pressure by releasing those people they arrested in 1961, by unbanning those organizations they banned in 1960, and by now saying that, come, let us talk. And essentially, the government is now saying, okay, we have heard, let us talk. Now, it is important for people to realize that he is saying this after at least two things have happened. The first one, the resistance on the ground. I can tell you today that even if somebody, some well-respected politician can stand up and say, okay, people, give them time. That is wasting his time, that person. The resistance on the ground is unbelievably strong. And that was that resistance. The demands of the workers is unbelievable. They are too strong. They are well-organized. And then the government has got economic problems. Now it's important to realize, you know, I really did not speak of many actors here who were there. Take, for example, what was the role of American corporations, which have been General Motors, Ford, Colgate, Palmolive, Coca-Cola, etc., etc. Now, between most of them came to South Africa during the boom era of the post-World War period. And virtually all of them took advantage of A, the law was clear, no black person can belong to a union or you'll be arrested. They did not resist that. Most of them took advantage. There was what we call job reservation. No black person could be a supervisor or a manager. Most of them went along. They employed white people there. Black people are just ordinary workers. Even those who went to university, got Bachelor of Science, they couldn't become that. So they all obeyed. And more than that, why? Now the question is, why did they do that? A, because black workers were not unionized, they were paid very little money. And they couldn't complain. Once you try to complain, the army comes on the factory, arrests you. And sometimes not only that, but the factory itself tells the army that there is somebody here who's making the workers to complain. And so there was that collaboration for many years. More than that, the government was all too willing to come in and protect them because these companies were paying heavy taxes to the government, which was used to administer apartheid bureaucracy. And so there is a way in which the argument that the presence of American companies there makes a difference is just what we call political and historical nonsense, because they've been there for more than 40 years and really hadn't made. The only time that they started making a difference was when the black people said, well, you better go back home. And they started saying, no, we cannot go back home. We can actually start help you with the houses. But they never did that. And when black people said that, no, you are giving the government, for example, let me give you an example of General Motors. They would have an agreement with the government that you produce so many cars, they become police cars. We don't know how the government buys them, but you'll see all the police cars arresting people, you know, throwing them into those cars. And people were aware of this collusion. And because of, on account of that, it led to the people say that, well, we really think that your presence here, rather than really improving us, which has not really ever improved us, it is strengthening the government, and so on. Now, that is why the theory that the presence of foreign corporations in South Africa improves the black people, it's historical and political nonsense. The best that it happens is that it begins to do that when black people organize themselves and assert themselves. And in reality, that does happen. But without that, it's not an automatic thing. Now, I've really ended in this issue, and I could say that we are in an important era in the country, the era where, for the first time in the history, in 300 years, the white people in South Africa are accepting that there is no future for that country without jointly working together, running the country with black people. There are various options that have been presented. The first option is what we call the federalist option, basically that the country belongs, be broken into various regions and each be represented in a government which is not really powerful, but the regions themselves be powerful, like have its own. They normally use the Switzerland as a model. It's a confederation. The other option is that the black people have their own representatives per quota in the parliament, and the white people have their own representatives in the parliament, and so on. So that there is what is called power sharing, political power sharing, on the basis of group representation, and those groups are racially defined. And the other option is simply that let every person nominate a person, what is called the universal franchise of one person, one vote, irrespective of race or creed. All these things are what is being debated about the future constitution, and I can mention this, that it is going to be difficult. There are many reasons why it's going to be difficult. The first one is that the laws that were passed, even if they can be repealed today, they have already made a way of life. Especially, they had given some form of protection, especially to the white people, that for them to face life without those protections. I think people should realize that for it would be a rare occasion for a white person to be unemployed. You choose maybe to be unemployed because the state was the largest employer. It would employ you in the railways, in the airways, in the postal services, even in the bureaucracy. There are a number of administrative bureaucracy for Africans. So that if a time comes when the state can no longer have this preferential employment of the African, what will they do? And many of them are not necessarily skilled in terms of education. You could easily leave school and become a train driver. I've never seen a black train driver. So that, do you know that? It's reserved for white people. And many other things that are crazy when you really come to think of them. I mean, like air hostess, etc. We don't have them. That's white people only. Now, once those things, once those privileges legally are removed, it will be very difficult. It's easy for people who survived without their protection. But for those people who went to school knowing, and issues of schools, for example, universities. There are African universities, as you may know, where you don't even have to compete for a space. It's guaranteed. You just have to pass, to qualify. And the state pays, for that matter, and so on. And now all those things are changing. And because of those changes, that is why I say it's going to be difficult. But it's important, you know. One of the things that I try to remind the Americans is that in South Africa, you do still have these two distinct nationalities. One is the British, the other one is the Dutch. I found that most of the people today who are strong supporters of the black cause, if they happen to be white, they would also be of Dutch descent. They have a way of an honesty that once they accept this is wrong, they go wholehearted. There's no hypocrisy or hiding. For an example, Dutch people have one passport, South African passport. Most British South Africans, English speaking, have two passports, British passport and South African passport. So when things get tough, they will go to New Zealand, they will go to Britain, etc. But Afrikaners are theirs, their home. And the day they decide that this is madness, let's try and make a home together with Africans, it's going to be an unbelievable paradise. It's only a matter of time. And I've no illusion that they will soon realize that there's no option.
How do the numbers compare?
I'm not sure whether for the purpose of this, can I give time so that the Tate Ministry people can know? Could we give 10 minutes discussion, if we allow, and then we'll wrap it, we'll conclude. Yes, please, a question.
How do the numbers compare the Afrikaans to the British?
It's 60% Afrikaners, 40% British of the white constituency. But of course, you do have German, French, Portuguese, and many other minority groups, who like Greeks and so on, Jews. But in broad outline, you really say that is 40-60.
I wonder what the best companies are that we can boycott.
The issue of companies really is a very serious issue, and there are those companies which play tricks, which delay, and then which really continue to support South African government. I wouldn't know, but I do know that there are serious research is being given to the issue, and the churches, for example, the Lutheran Church does have an office that advises people on what which company is doing what, because people are saying that let us do this responsibly. And let us not only tell people not to apply sanctions, but let us tell them how to be positive about their investment, because they are actually positive investment opportunities. For example, the issue of the Lutheran pension fund, it is not as if there is no alternative way to make that money productive. If you choose to, you can find better ways, and ways that also are socially responsible. So I cannot say offhand which ones, I cannot identify, but I can simply say the issue of sanctions is still an issue for us, because we think that once you delay it, the discussions are not yet, have not yet reached a stage where a person can say no. But I do not believe, and this is the same belief of people, that sometimes that sanctions are an end in themselves. They really means, and the day we realize that the goal is in sight, many people will tell you that, please come.